We are happy to announce that this episode of the SW Show is partially brought to you by Humble Bundle. Well, not really. We are part of the Humble Bundle referral program, and we just wanted to say that if you like really cheap games and maybe helping charity pending the Humble thing going on, all you have to do is go to humblebundle.com/?partner equals SWW. That's right, humblebundle.com/?partner equals SWW. And you just do your normal stuff, and it just kind of helps us get a couple bucks here and there. Maybe it helps AJ get his lights. Maybe it's my camera. Maybe we actually pay Corey for helping us out. But again, if you're going to go buy games anyway, it might be worth checking out.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Movie Club episode where we review Dune Part 2. Or as the movie poster that we're looking at, it has a do part two.
So, yes. So we are here to talk about Dune Part 2, which I'm just going to clarify for the record. We did not watch the first one together. You cannot convince me that was true.
I'm pretty sure we did. We didn't do it for Movie Club, but I'm fairly certain we did.
I like how I have yet to look into my HBO Max history and that would answer the question. like, I should deep.
I don't know, since we would have watched it through Senior, I don't know how that would interact with your...
Oh, watch history.
Watch history. Right. I mean, it should be fine. But yeah, I don't know.
That's a... But yeah, we're here to talk about Dune Part 2. So, I'm trying to
think... It would only be on my watch history, I think, right?
But I don't like my account. Remember, it made us both have accounts.
Yeah. Yeah, you had to sign in through your HBO account, but it only ran my library.
Right, because you had the control.
Yeah, so I think it would only show up on my watch history. But yeah.
Anyway. Very possible. Okay. Dune Part 2. Tell me where to start. I'm going to start with the text I sent you, which is, got to be honest, this might be one of the best sci-fi movies I've ever seen. I don't even know.
I mean, on that. Denis Villeneuve has quickly transformed himself into the top sci-fi director of the past 10 years. Between like, this, the first
one. Nolan, right? Or like our two sci-fi, like.
Yeah, between this, the first one, and then Blade Runner, right? Like.
And, like, I know you don't love it, but, like, we both know Arrival is a widely recognized film, too.
Yeah, but that's out of the decade time span.
That's fair. No, Arrival's 2016. It'd be within a decade.
Was it? Yeah. For some reason, I thought it was 2013.
No, 2013 is Enemy and Prisoners. So. Yeah, so no, but either way, like.
Four movies.
Right, okay. When you last, like, he's a director that I feel like you could go and, like, he's the one you look at that snippet, looking back, and you'd be like, how? Because remember, if you do 5, it's Sicario mixed in. Because Sicario was 2015. That's within the last decade also.
Yeah.
Like, also...
Has anybody had a better decade?
Director stretch? Or actor? I can think of actors that might have. I don't know if I can think of a director.
Yeah, I mean, actually, we're talking about a director, no. So we're not going to talk about actors.
I bet you we could pull a better Nolan decade.
Okay. Mm.
We will start this correctly in a second, but okay, Nolan, I'm going to give it to you. Okay. Here's Christopher Nolan. One decade. Insomnia. Batman Begins. Prestige. Dark Knight. Inception. Dark Knight Rises.
Dark Knight Rises kind of takes it down a little bit.
Okay. Minus that. I still find.
Batman Begins also isn't that great.
That's fair. Okay, so then here's like, Nolan's last four films.
His Batman trilogy is definitely held up. Yeah, it's held up by Dark Knight. Like,
yeah, no, I actually do like Batman Begins a lot, but I do think Dark Knight's a very different level.
I think people look back on Begins with rose tinted glasses, going, "This is the guy that made Dark Knight, so Batman Begins must be good." And you look back and it's like, it's got stretches where it's all right, but it's, you can definitely see the workings of what would become.
But no, that is true. But yeah, we're Dune Part 2. But yeah, the big thing, like, I think immediately impressed by both how dense this film was, but how much I feel like they explained everything they needed to, or they left the audience with was there any spot in this film for being this dense that you were like, I have no clue what's going on? I don't mean the spots they might be confused. I mean, like, they explain and you're like, I still don't know what the hell's, or they didn't explain a thing, or.
Yeah, with Austin Butler's character.
Okay.
When you're first introduced to him.
The fight.
Like, yeah, it's like, okay, so I get it. You were trying to. Was Lord Harkonnen trying to kill him?
I don't think so. So I read that as it was Lord Harkonnen basically risking his life. So there's a level of risk thrown in there to basically prove to everyone that he was a fighter and not just the nephew. Because that's what it read like to me, was that, like, otherwise everyone just viewed him as, sure, we respect you because you're who you are and not because we actually respect you as, like, a fighter. Or we don't find you threatening. We find you threatening because you're a leader.
Yeah. Also, I find it interesting that the one that they didn't drug was the doctor who, in the first one, proved himself in hand-to-hand combat.
Yeah, no, that is very good. I do like how that was a good, like, how they're like, the final three members, and you're like, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Also, since we're talking about that, come on, mm-hmm. A full, like, 11 or 12 minute sequence shot fully on infrared cameras.
Right?
Like, I know Denis has a thing for using unique cameras. I mean, Sicario, he used both night vision and thermal. This is a whole new step.
John, honestly, was to me one of the, like, coolest scenes, like, look-wise.
Yeah, as, like, I had heard rumblings about, oh, they shot a whole scene in infrared, and, like, that's gonna look amazing.
And it did.
And I'm thinking, okay, you know, maybe it's a thing where, like, Paul's wearing goggles or something like that, but then to have the Harkonnen's home planet be where that was,
and not only that, it's still like I think the coolest shot was when you had all of the Bene Gesserit like show up and they just turn black and white, like as you see them walk into the light.
Yeah,
like it was this really cool like, oh, it like evaporates color.
Yeah. And anytime you saw Lord Harkonnen, you could see, like, okay, it's not really a real camera, because you could see kind of on the edges where the infrared was reading temperatures a little weird.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, okay, it's not like a fully clear image, but it looks cool as hell.
I gotta ask, how much of a fat suit was he in?
Stellan?
Yeah.
I watched his Vanity Fair, like, going through his career.
Mm-hmm.
And he said he was in the suit for 2 weeks, and he didn't drink and he took iodine pills, so he didn't have to piss or shit for 2 weeks. So I think it was not comfortable. He said it was 8 hours to get into the fat suit.
Because, like, I obviously recognize his face, but, like, yeah. The rest of that is, like, Jesus. There's no way he put on that weight.
Yeah.
But he was great. Like, also, the other one that I think needs to be shouted out, this is objectively, I think, Batista's best role. Like, I think he was impressive as can be. And I think, like, obviously, he's a lot of screen parts, but he's very good at that. But I think he's, like, I think he's found, like, his range, and also Danny Villeneuve apparently is just the director he should work with, is what we figured out.
Yeah.
But, like, I think, like, also, the other one
was the perfect role for him, right? Like,
Yeah. No, this is like a role made for him, but I think he shines because it's a role made for him. Because otherwise, like, legitimately, I don't I don't know who else I can think of, like, in that type of role that would have done it.
The guy that played Ivan's son in the Creed movies. Just some big yoke motherfucker. The guy that's playing
But you need some big yo.
the psycho in Borderlands. Like,
That's fair.
you know, maybe that wouldn't work because he would be too tall. And I think the design language is always that Lord Harkonnen is the tallest. Even though, yes, he's using the anti-grav system to
As I
achieve
said,
that.
he's literally being held up via like this mechanical.
Also, the artificial lung fits the Harkonnen design so well.
So I asked the other one
Yeah,
too.
dude,
So
the Harkonnen designs for everything were just
it was
great
beautiful.
because it was like over the spice harvesters being so big compared to the Atreides ones, which were the old
The other one I was going to, the
harvesters.
Harkonnen, when they're flying up, that was such a cool like scene. Like that was one of the scenes that like made most gasp of like they're just flying up and you're like, oh, you don't mess with these.
Oh, they're anti-grav suits.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I wish they explained that a little bit more because in the first one, it's just like a fall negation system. So it's like they're not true anti-grav systems. It slows their fall. And then suddenly they're like flying around. Now, granted, it's like a spacewalk flying, you know, it's they have to push off and then they kind of float. So yeah, I wish there was a way to explain the technology behind the houses. But
Like the
then
only
thinking about it,
thing
like, how do you.
Yeah, how do you?
You know, you would have had to do it in the first one. And how do you keep these movies feeling the way they do
And explain
while
everything?
also lore dumping, like, oh, the Harkonnens can like levitate kind of. Or
Yeah,
they've
I don't
at
know
least
how
figured out
you.
gravity.
Because like there's so much you have to explain. Like I also think part of this film thrives because it doesn't explain. So a perfect example is like the box. Like we understand the box conceptually, but there's no one sitting there and explaining the technology, and it's like we don't need to because like we fundamentally get it too.
I
Of
wanted to
like you're dealing with
see.
these like, but you're dealing with like these witches. Like it's such an easy like they're witch like basically witches. They're messing with you. Go for it.
I so wanted to see the let me pull up his character's name. Fade Rautha's box scene. Because somebody that is so psychotic, like, that's the whole point of the box is like to face your fear and figure
But
out who
like
you
that little
really
thing,
are.
you may comment out like to him, he just thrived with it or what? Like it was like, yeah, he's a masochist, I think they said.
And he's driven by sexual favors, I think, is what Florence Pugh's
Because
character
she's
says.
pregnant at the end of it. It's because he impregnates
Yeah,
the
he
lady
impregnates
Margot.
Florence. No.
No, it's like Margot. It's not Florence Pugh. Florence Pugh didn't go down. It was Lady Margot. Lady Margot is the one who went down and see him and did the boxing. That's why Florence Pugh gets sent to do that.
Oh, that's right, 'cause she's the
Florence Pugh is the daughter of the Emperor.
Yeah, I know. But I swear it was her.
No, it was not.
I'm getting my blonde actresses mixed up.
It was Lea Seydoux, I think's her name.
Lea Seydoux, yeah.
Yeah, she was the Bond girl in like Spectre and Skyfall, or Spectre in No Time.
Yeah,
she was in Inglourious Basterds.
No, she's yeah. Very shortly. Well, yeah, very shortly in Inglourious Basterds.
Yeah, yeah.
Blue is the warmest color. She's been in a ton of stuff. But yeah, this is just the ability that they're like, it's a girl to keep the bloodline. And I'm like, I get that it's the year 10,000.
Mm-hmm.
But just having in there that, like, the Bene Gesserit can
do that.
Just, like, genetically modify their
ovaries to produce. No. They're not. They'd be modifying the guy.
Well, no, they're genetically modifying their eggs to only produce women. Or it's a hormonal thing. However they're doing it, right? Like,
yeah, it's hormonal. I think we agree, like, it's hormonal.
It's just
a power. It's an insane power.
It's quote-unquote magic.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which I do find it odd that in a society, in a world like Dune, where technology really doesn't exist.
Interesting, like, technology exists, but it doesn't. Like, it's very limited. Like, but, like, they're space-bearing, but it's very, like...
Yeah, the Fremens have laser weapons. But then it's, like, everyone's fighting hand-to-hand with swords. But then there's these physics shields, but then there's magic women that rule the world that can decide whether or not they're gonna have a girl.
And I guess I'm still intrigued by the physics shield, about the, like, you could slowly put a blade through, like, there's a lot
it's an inertia shield is actually what it is. So it's like,
okay,
if you slow it down, you can puncture it
less. Yeah,
but it's like inverse to the inertia that's hitting it. So it's why, like,
a bullet stops, but like a slow blade wouldn't.
It's like the scene from the first one where Jason Momoa is like taking shots from swords and they're just like bouncing off. Mm-hmm. But it was only when somebody was wrestling him down that they could kill him. You know, it was only when the fly slowed down that it could vibrate its way, excuse me, through the inertia shield. You know, it's why, like, when you see the, there's a couple times during the big battle where it's like, it's clear that the Fremen have figured this out, so it's why they switched to hand-to-hand jiu-jitsu-based combat. Because it's like, you can still interact with the shield. It's not like it's a force field.
Right, you can still move it and touch it.
So you can grab that and potentially get through there. But yeah. Yeah, it's like, it's odd, right? It's very, steampunk's not the right word, because they're space-bearing, so it'd be like space-punk.
I don't know a better term than space-punk, which, to me, if we're being objective, it's probably Dune invented the style, or whatever, I've been aping it.
Well, NASA invented space-punk, but yeah.
But like, it's kind of like how the amount of people who have been having Star Wars realizations over the last week or two is pretty funny.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not a one-to-one, but there is parallels.
Yeah. The people that are figuring out that Dune is actually just a, like, telling of Christianity is way too high. Christianity
meets Judaism meets Islam. Like, it's a mixture of the big three monotheistics.
It's way too high. It's very figuring that out. Like,
this is the first time that, like, I think a lot of people have heard of Dune, I feel like for a lot of people, this was exposure to what Dune is.
And I guess since the first two movies are just the first book, the first book doesn't get too off the rails with the religious aspect of it. But by the end of it, like, Paul Atreides is basically Jesus.
Okay, he's already... What do you mean basically?
Well, no, in the sense of, like, so he is... In this, he's seen as a Messiah.
Right, and his argument is he the Messiah? Yeah.
Right, but towards the end of Herbert's books, he is Jesus, like, healing and walking on water, like, that kind of stuff. Like, but, yeah, I mean, too, it's one of the situations of... that this movie tries to portray that, like, I don't know. I hate this trope because it just becomes an easy trope, and a lot of movies have done it lately, of, you know, outside invaders come in, and then the locals that are, like, you know, very behind in technology have to fend for themselves, but it's only through the help of an outsider. And obviously, like, Frank Herbert didn't invent that with the first Dune book. That's a story that's been passed down forever.
Right.
But it's just like, there's so many projects out right now that basically ape the same thing. And the fact that I didn't feel that way coming out of the Dune movies.
You know, the Dune movie, it totally is, like, in its broad sense, stories that have been told before, but yeah, it's not a... At no point did it feel like I've seen this before.
And I think the part that helps is Paul doesn't want to be the Messiah.
Mm-hmm.
But then as soon as he realizes that he is the Messiah, that power trip just takes over him.
Yeah,
and it's
such a...
I saw somebody call it a feel-bad movie, which is exactly what it is, right? Like, you end up feeling bad for the Fremen. Like,
it's episode 5. Like, at the end of the day, like, this is totally that, like, mid of, hopefully, a trilogy that is the, like, the dark period in a lot of ways. But in the weird way, it's, like, gonna be objective. Dune doesn't get lighter.
No.
This is the light stuff of Dune, too. Like, this is gonna be... Interesting, but I also want to touch base on that. We're talking about, like, this being this type of film. Like, at one point, just to clarify, this is a film we're talking about. There is a telepathic baby that turns out to, like, at one point we get to see, and it turns to be Anna Taylor-Joy. Like the idea I want to put on another thing. That's another scene that, like, somehow makes sense in the context of this film.
Yeah, that,
which is the wild.
The Namibian beach scene that you're talking about perfectly encapsulates that conversation that Paul ends up having with Zendaya's character.
Mm-hmm.
Where he sees the sand leading to oceans of green. And... you know, Namibia is one of those countries where the dune is literally right next to the ocean, and it's very tall. So that scene just sets such a great example of, without having to do CG work, which the CG work that is in this movie, like the laser weapons taking down the spice harvesters, they make it look real.
Also, I wanted to shout that out too. The thing I noticed in this film is, I don't know if you noticed, because we were talking about specific, because we know the Borderlands is supposed to make fun of because there's no shadows in it. This film, on those desert scenes, you can tell we're filmed in a desert. Otherwise, they hand put in those shadows to a comical effect. So either way, it's like this, the editing and shooting of this film, like, shook me to death. Like, especially modern films, where it is so much like, here's the 360 green screen go. Like, you just kind of tell some of this was, like, shot actually at spots.
Yeah, I mean, they shot it in Jordan. They shot it in Namibia. They shot it in, I think, there was one other, Saudi Arabia or something like that. I know they shot in Turkey. Like, going back to the shot that I'm talking of, where they use the laser weapons to bring down the spice harvesters.
That's so cool.
Like, when the lasers first, like, have trigger, like, material interaction. You see that, like, the beam first hits the balloon and then burns its way through the balloon and then has to catch the other side and burn its way through the other side.
Yeah, when it went all the way through, was that other one? I was like, what the hell? Like, yeah. I expected it not. Like, I expected it, like, to go partially, you hit it, you cause an explosion, you call it a day. Like, that's what I was expecting. Versus it being this all the way through as we cut it up, as you see it, like, fall. Like, it's like, yeah, I don't want. Also, we're saying all this with this film, like, this film having an objectively better budget than last one, but, like, these aren't high budget films in modern days. Like, this was $190 million box office, which is a real budget. But, like, the last one, wasn't it, like, $95 million or some nonsense? Like, it was a comic low budget.
Yeah. Like, but, I mean, Denis has shown that he can stretch the dollar pretty fucking far. So, giving him a small budget, I don't think really matters. But, also, like, we're talking about this, and then they just drop the ultimate hammer of, oh, the Atreides have 90 nukes.
That is the great, we're good. Tell me it's not the great, like, moment when all of a sudden he's like, I have the nuclear arsenal. I went, huh? In my head, immediately in this one, I went, there are nukes?
Well, not only are there nukes, but nobody else has nukes?
No, they all have nukes, but they're the ones who brought it to this world, which is what I found interesting. Why are the Harkonnen not bringing it to this world? They're nukes, also.
I don't think the Harkonnens have nukes.
But he said every family has nukes.
No, he said the Atreides house gathered all of the nuclear arsenal. They were entrusted with the arsenal.
I heard it as each house got an arsenal.
So, no, Atreides oversaw the arsenal. So it's just like, hey, neighbor, let's all gather our nukes, and you're going to watch over them. So nobody else has nukes. Why does nobody else have nukes?
Yeah.
Like, why? The Harkonnens clearly are up to shit. You're telling me Baron Harkin didn't have, like, the ability to make nukes under the radar? You know, like, also, I genuinely thought during
the... And in the book, sorry, I pulled this up, by the way, in the books, at least all the families have there. I can't tell in this movie if that was true. In the books, every family has nukes.
Yeah. Yes, that's... Book-wise, yes, but in the movie, they say the Atreides family was entrusted to watch over the arsenal. Also, like, you know, they mention and they show that Lady Atreides is a Harkonnen.
Yeah, which means he's a Harkonnen.
So when Paul has to use his genetic code to unlock the arsenal, his dad had to have known.
Why? Because he would start. Because the way I viewed it as, he just needed to have like code of it, of like anyone of the ancestry would have it.
Well, no, because that's the whole thing about Josh Brolin's character. He says it's tied to your genetic code.
No, but I read it as like all of them would have, like all the Atreides would have this genetic code. Like it's just like the Atreides bloodline is what it was. I don't think he like took his son specifically. I think it's any Atreides could have opened it.
Maybe, remember, but
he's the final Atreides. So like that's part of this too. Like,
yes and no.
Okay. Sure. On paper of alive that we know of, he's the final Atreides. Yeah. That isn't in a womb, like.
Yeah. So, it does raise the question of, like, did his dad know? And even though...
But his mom said she didn't know until she took it.
But right. I'm like... The Bene Gesserit know who she is. So they knew she's a Harkonnen.
Right, no, the Bene Gesserit know. That is true. Like, I now want to go back
and watch the first one and see if they hint any of the times that you see other Bene Gesserit members.
Mm-hmm.
I want to see if they're hinting that Lady Atreides is not an Atreides. So...
That is true.
That is the ultimate foreshadowing, and that's awesome.
Right. No, and also in general, like, having the shadow group that, like... So the thing with the Dune, which is, I think, very interesting, like, as a story, it's about knowing the end, and it's just about figuring out the journey. And I think also as a narrative conceit, that's really cool, especially, like, modern stories. It's almost funny, because modern stories, we complain that they're too, like, obvious what they're happening. But this film just goes, we're showing you the ending. And now you just come with us for the ride.
Yeah.
And, like, that's such an interesting thing to me. But the one I want to shout out to, though, too, and I think it's someone that it's funny because I completely forgot he was in this, but I do think deserves to be cut out, and we kind of talked about it, or, like, me and you, is I forgot Christopher Walken was the Emperor. And when he came out, I was like, oh, my God. But I gotta say, as much as he is the actor the most that you can't blend into a role because of who he is, I at least think he pulled it really well. And I think he actually made the Emperor somewhat of a scary person. It's someone who's threatening in isolation. Yeah. But he's threatening until he gets... Like, he's threatening, like, in this isolation, like, he's the Emperor. But the moment, like, think how easy he gets taken over. And stopped. He comes down, and mystically, 20 seconds later, they're surrounded.
Yeah, I read the... when they showed that it's Christopher Walken, like, and that he was very frail, I read into that as, oh, like, people don't know what the Emperor looks like. So he's only...
Oh, that's very true, I bet.
He's only threatening if you don't know who he is. And as soon as you see him, it's like, oh, this dude's like a, you know, a has-been from 50 years ago. So, that's how I read casting him. Also, seeing Paul go up to the throne. that shot is going to be so cool when they pull that off.
There's going to be many shots in this film. I feel like you could just kind of frame a look. Like, you know, yeah, other person I do think we need to shout out, though, too, before we get into it, is Javier Bardem. Javier Bardem, I think, as Stilgar was, like, a perfect cast.
Drink every time he says La Salle Al-Gaib. You'll be hammered for an hour's over.
Like, it was such a good, like, every time something happened, he was like, see, he's the chosen one.
Yeah. See? But yeah, getting back to your point of being able to frame these shots, like, that is what Villeneuve does best. Right? You go back to the first Sicario. There's so many landscape shots in that movie that you could frame. You know, it sucks that he's not doing it anymore, but every frame of painting would have a field day with the Dune movies.
Because it would just be the whole
beautiful.
It would be the whole film. Like, honestly.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's a few scenes where it's like, okay, you know.
No, it's not perfect. But, like, cool, I do think.
Yeah.
I think in modern, like in films last few years, I think this will come down as like definitely one of the best shot ones. Pretty easily.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it sucks that this came out March 1st. So it'll get forgotten come award season next year.
But it definitely still like cinematography or editing. I think it should be kind of up yeah, there.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying. Like this movie should take cinematography and nobody should just don't apply for an award. Just say like, yep, Denis, you and your DP, you got it. Like, not even gonna try. It's just not worth it. Because yeah, there's so many shots. I mean, even you think about like some of the shots that you don't really need, like Paul riding the biggest sandworm they've ever seen. Mm-hmm. There's shots while he's doing that it's like they clearly just strapped this dude onto a trailer and drove in the desert. Like, it's not CG.
Like, it might be something stepped on it, but yeah, it's not CG in that way we're thinking of it at all.
Like, he's clearly going through the desert getting blasted by sand. Also, I just love that they're like, hey, we don't have vehicles, so we're going to ride these fuck-off large sandworms.
Would he summon the biggest one of all time? It's such a good, like, moment.
Yeah, which is odd. Like, they don't... They call it the grandfather worm in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the only reference to it being big. It's never said that he got the biggest.
That was when they came back.
It wasn't until
when they talked to his mom, that's when they commented about how it was the biggest.
It was the biggest one they had seen. It's not mentioned that it's the biggest one, which in the book, I think it is the biggest sandworm.
Yeah.
On Arrakis. But yeah, it's like, everybody's like, oh, they clearly say that it's the biggest one ever. Like, no, they call it the grandfather one. And then they tell his mom that he rode the biggest one they've ever seen. So people are conflating stuff, which is fine, right? Like, it's that is cutting hairs on what it actually means, but it's still one of those situations where it's like, dude, you had such a cool instance of, as he's doing that, the comedy of everyone going, not that big, not that big. Knowing that, I mean, Barnum's character is the only one that knows what that worm is.
Mm-hmm.
He's the only one that knows in the group, at least, that Paul has summoned the grandfather worm. Which makes me wonder, like, his group of nomads that he's with, do these guys have the worms named?
Yeah, this is... Like, do they know them? Do they have, like, their favorite?
Grandfather worm, like, do each of the worms have a specific rhythm?
I never thought of that. That's like, a very interesting, like, do they?
As they're saying that, I'm like, okay, like, so what's going on, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But
no, that's fair. But yeah, I think that's everything. I think we're both gonna say that. Everything. Go see this film in theaters. Go make this break every record. We would like more of these. We would like there to be a Dune Messiah.
I mean, the script's also done, we didn't show them. Yeah,
it's a matter of if it's greenlit, which I'm assuming it's gonna be. It's a matter of when.
Yeah.
Also, we didn't gently shut them off, but obviously, everyone we did shut on this film. I don't know of any of the main cast. I think there's a bad cast member in this film. I just want, like, it's just one of those, for a collection of people this big and a film this big and, let's be honest, very intense to explain, I don't think we could have got a better version of this. Because this, if this was made 20 years ago, I'm scared what this film would have looked like. Point blank.
Yes. Yeah.
Go check it out.
So. We will see everyone in the next one.
The SWW Show and all of its affiliate podcasts are podcasts by me, Mike Maroney, and AJ Losey, sometimes by contributors, including Corey King. You can follow the SWW Show on social media at the SWW Show, or sooner or later you go to patreon.com/SWW to help us out. Thank you, and we hope you enjoy the rest of your day.